Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this critical election year, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the stories that matter most. And we count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Signed up for a monthly donation of, say, just $6, we could cover our operating costs for the entire year. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Stay safe. Wear a mask, save lives, and thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I was told that when they bring immigrants in, that they were a headcount for pay. It's not an attack on LaSalle, and it's not an attack on ICDC. All I want is that people are treated and triaged medically correct. I became a whistleblower. Now I'm a target. But I'll take a target any day to do what's right and just, then sit and be a part of what's inhumane.
As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 nears 200,000, we'll speak to a nurse whistleblower inside an ICE prison in Georgia about shocking allegations from ignoring public health protocols during the pandemic to the forced sterilization and hysterectomies of detained immigrant women. We'll also look at the latest death inside an ICE prison. Plus, we'll look at Belly of the Beast, a disturbing new documentary on California's dark history of forced sterilizations inside women's prisons.
You gave me a hysterectomy for severe cramps. You did a pelvic exam.
He gave me some kind of test and said I had some fibroid.
I was told that I had cancer cells.
They told me that I had to have my ovaries removed. I had no choice.
We actually used to call them the surgeries of the month because they were happening so frequently. So many people were getting hysterectomies. That was a cure-all. That's what it was.
We'll speak to the film's director as well as a survivor of sterilization abuse who sued the state of California over the practice. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Washington, D.C., the Republican race to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court is running full speed. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's charging ahead with plans to vote on President Trump's nominee.
The Senate has more than sufficient time to process a nomination. History and precedent make that perfectly clear.
President Trump said Monday he would announce his nominee by week's end. McConnell refused to hold confirmation hearings in 2016 for President Obama's nominee 9 months before the election. So far, only two Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Maine's Susan Collins, have said they do not support voting before the November election. Democrats need four Republicans to join them to block the nomination. But on Monday, Democrats were dealt a major setback when Republican Senator Cory Gardner, who's trailing Democrat John Hickenlooper in the Colorado Senate race, and Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, said they both supported holding a vote on a nominee before the election. Trump appeared by phone on Fox News Monday, falsely claiming Ginsburg's dying wish that she not be replaced until a new president is installed was a Democratic hoax.
I don't know that she said that, or was that written out by Adam Schiff and Schumer and Pelosi? I would be more inclined to the second.
Justice Ginsburg is scheduled to lie in state in the Capitol Friday, the first woman to receive the honor. Before this, she'll lie in repose at the Supreme Court for 2 days outside due to the pandemic. She will be interred at a private service Tuesday at Arlington National Cemetery, where her husband, Martin Ginsburg, was also buried in 2010. Attorney General William Barr is threatening to cut billions of dollars in federal funds to New York City, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon, after designating the cities as so-called anarchist jurisdictions. The Justice Department claims the cities, quote, have permitted violence and destruction of property to persist. New York Attorney General Letitia James slammed the designation as illegal. She said, quote, this designation is nothing more than a pathetic attempt to scare Americans into voting for a commander-in-chief who's actually incapable of commanding our nation, she said. As the U.S. coronavirus death toll hits 200,000, the Centers for Disease Control is facing new criticism. On Friday, the CDC posted guidance on its website stating for the first time that COVID-19 could possibly be spread by airborne transmission. But then on Monday, the CDC deleted the information, saying it was posted in error. This marks the third time the CDC has posted coronavirus guidance and then reversed its position. Meanwhile, Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has signed a memo barring the Food and Drug Administration and other health agencies from issuing or signing any new rules without his signature. Critics describe Azar's move as a power grab at a time when the FDA will play a pivotal role in the approval process for a potential COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, the Daily Beast has revealed that a public relations staffer inside the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases secretly ran a right-wing website where he called his boss, Dr. Anthony Fauci, a mask Nazi and implied that, quote, government officials responsible for the pandemic response should be executed, unquote. The staffer, William Cruz, announced his retirement Monday after the Daily Beast exposed his work at the website redstate.com. In international news, 156 nations have formally joined together to ensure the fair distribution of future COVID-19 vaccines. The United States and China have both declined to join the effort known as COVAX, which is being organized by the World Health Organization. A new report by House Democrats finds immigrant prisoners in U.S. custody systematically receive inadequate medical, dental, and mental health care and face solitary confinement as a punishment for speaking out. The report also details how immigrants are forced to perform unpaid labor, including cleaning the prisons. As coronavirus cases continue to surge inside Immigration and Customs Enforcement prisons, the report notes, quote, the spread of COVID-19 has further highlighted how the failures to meet these standards of care are a matter of life and death, unquote. In related news, Cipriano Chavez Alvarez, a 61-year-old man from Mexico, died early Monday in a Georgia hospital after getting COVID-19 while imprisoned at the privately run Stewart Detention Center. He's the 20th person to die while in ICE custody this fiscal year, the highest number in the past 15 years. At least seven of these deaths have been related to COVID-19. In Afghanistan, dozens of security personnel and Taliban fighters were killed across Afghanistan Sunday in the bloodiest day of fighting since intra-Afghan peace talks began a little over a week ago. On Saturday, at least 12 civilians were reportedly killed in airstrikes on a Taliban base in the northeastern province of Kunduz. In Colombia, at least six people were killed in what locals say was a massacre Sunday in the southwest region of Cauca. At least one child was among the victims. A local organization says this is the 10th massacre in the region so far this year. Monitoring groups say at least 60 massacres have occurred across Colombia this year, killing 244 people. Social leaders in particular have been targeted by armed groups. Human rights activists and members of the filmmaking industry are calling for the release of award-winning Sudanese filmmaker Hajuj Kuka, who was sentenced to 2 months in jail alongside four other artists after their theater workshop was raided. Critics say it's part of a crackdown on the arts and activism. Hajuj Kuka is a member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and is best known for his documentary Beats of the Antonov. He was active during the Sudanese revolution that ousted longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April of 2019. Scientists say Arctic sea ice shrank to its second lowest level on record this summer due to global heating. A recent study found the climate in the Arctic is changing so rapidly, the landscape is drastically shifting from being covered in ice and snow to being characterized by open water and rain. This is Dr. Laura Meller of Greenpeace.
The rapid loss of sea ice in the Arctic is a sobering indicator of how closely our planet is circling the drain. And as the Arctic melts, more heat will be absorbed by the ocean and all of us will be more exposed to the devastating impacts of climate breakdown.
The Trump administration's tapped a meteorologist who questions the link between extreme weather and climate change to be the new chief scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Ryan Maui is a former scholar at the libertarian Cato Institute, who's publicly criticized many prominent climate scientists, including Dr. James Hansen and the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Texas has issued disaster declarations in over two dozen counties, and Louisiana has declared a state of emergency as Tropical Storm Beta made landfall late Monday, causing flooding along the coastline and washing away Galveston, Texas pier. The Atlantic's record-breaking hurricane season this year marks just the second time in history meteorologists have had to start naming storms using the Greek alphabet after exhausting possible names from letters A to W. In California, two Kumeyaay land defenders were arrested on Monday as the community engages in an ongoing protest against Trump's border wall on sacred land. Kumeyaay land defenders and allies have peacefully camped and held prayer ceremonies along the wall's construction route in the San Diego area for several weeks, successfully blocking the construction of nearly a mile of the border wall. The Bureau of Land Management yesterday presented an order to evict the camp, threatening protesters with arrest if they don't leave. The camp has also faced surveillance and harassment from Border Patrol and ICE and local white supremacists. In related news, Gizmodo reports Customs and Border Protection drones conducted flyovers near the homes of indigenous anti-pipeline activists, including Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Meanwhile, in Arizona, Tohono O'odham land and water defenders led a protest Monday blocking the border wall's construction for several hours near a sacred spring inside the Organ Pipe National Monument. Protesters carried a banner that said borders equals genocide, no wall on O'odham land. National Park Service and Border Patrol agents on the scene started shoving protesters, forcing them to disperse after an hours-long standoff. Wall construction crews in the Sonoran Desert have destroyed pristine landscape and pumped millions of gallons of groundwater used to mix cement for Trump's wall. The Government Accountability Office is investigating the Pentagon's interest in using heat rays against protesters near the White House, as well as the use of other so-called non-lethal weapons that were deployed on anti-police brutality protesters in recent months. Demands for an independent investigation into the use of force began in June, days after federal police violently cleared peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square in D.C. with tear gas and smoke. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis announced plans for new legislation that aims to clamp down on protests. The new measures, if passed, would charge protesters with felonies for property damage and impose mandatory jail time for hitting a police officer. The bill would also block local jurisdictions that move to defund police from receiving Florida state grants. In Nebraska, a white bar owner who was indicted last week in the fatal shooting of James Scurlock, a black protester, died by suicide. Jake Gardner died Sunday, the day he was due to turn himself into authorities. James Scurlock was shot dead on May 30th during protests over the killing of George Floyd. He was 22 years old. And in Kentucky, the Louisville police announced a state of emergency Monday as the city prepares for a grand jury decision in the police killing of Breonna Taylor. Police fatally shot the 26-year-old black emergency room technician in her own home on March 13th. Federal buildings have been closed for the week in Louisville, and federal forces were called into the city last week. Meanwhile, authorities in Wisconsin have announced the investigation of the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha has entered its final stages. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the quarantine report. When we come back, as COVID spreads in ICE jails and another immigrant was reported dead from the virus Monday in a Georgia ICE jail, we'll go to Georgia to speak with a nurse whistleblower who says ICE ignored public health protocols during the pandemic and forcibly sterilized detained immigrant women. Dawn Wooten will join us from Atlanta. Stay with us. Vashti Bunyan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the official death toll from COVID-19 in the United States is just hitting 200,000, though the real number is almost certainly far higher. Some public health experts say infections could spike this fall and winter and double the death count by the end of the year. As the virus continues to spread, we look now at allegations that Immigration and Customs Enforcement helped spread the virus through medical neglect and abuse in ICE jails. On Monday, ICE confirmed the 20th person to die in its detention in fiscal year 2020, making it one of the deadliest periods in the agency's history. Cipriano Chavez Alvarez was a 61-year-old Mexican immigrant who'd been held at the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, and died in a nearby hospital. His passing marks the third COVID-19 fatality at that jail and the eighth known COVID death in ICE custody. ICE says nearly 5,700 prisoners nationwide have been infected with COVID. This comes as an explosive complaint filed on behalf of a whistleblower nurse accuses a different ICE jail in Georgia, the Irwin County Detention Center, of failing to protect both prisoners and employees from the virus. The whistleblower, Dawn Wooten, was a nurse at the jail. She said it failed to adhere to coronavirus safety protocols. She also alleges a large number of unwanted hysterectomies have been performed on prisoners by a local doctor known as the uterus collector. The complaint does not name a specific staff doctor, but lawyers for several people detained there have told Tina Vasquez at Prism and other news outlets, including The New York Times, that he's an obstetrics and gynecology specialist named Mahendra Amin, who has an office in the city of Douglas near the ICE jail. It's been reported that Amin and other doctors previously paid $500,000 in a settlement of a civil federal Medicare fraud allegation. The Intercept reported that three prisoners said Amin had performed at least 20 hysterectomies over 6 years. One said while Amin was excising a cyst from her ovary, he removed part of a fallopian tube without her consent. Amin told The Intercept that, quote, everything is wrong about the complaint. ICE said in a statement that only two prisoners at Irwin County had undergone hysterectomies since 2018 and has not confirmed how many other potentially sterilizing surgeries were done, such as tubal ligations. Dawn Wooten will join us in a minute to describe what she saw. She spoke out after nine women detained in Irwin managed to film and have uploaded to YouTube in April. The women wore makeshift masks and held signs that said, "There are sick people here. We are not criminals, and please help." One by one, they came forward to tell their stories.
I work in intake. I see the people who enter. I see how the guards work. All I saw is that they ask people to leave. When they enter, men, women, whoever, they don't attend to them. They don't ask them the necessary questions to diagnose them. We are at risk. They don't give us anything to cover ourselves so that we can protect ourselves. I was the first person that got sick. I went to the clinic and that it lasted no more than 5 minutes. They didn't give me necessary resources. They simply told me, "You're fine, go back to your cell."
We need protection, please. All we want is for people to listen to their conscience, their hearts. Because we are so many mothers in this place who are suffering so much, so many humiliations for the love of God. Why can't ICE understand? Why do we have to wait more than a year to get a court date?
That was April. On Monday, Democrats on the House Homeland Security Committee issued a report that concluded immigrants in ICE jails systematically receive inadequate medical, dental, and mental health care and face solitary confinement as a punishment for speaking out. As coronavirus cases continue to surge inside ICE prisons, the report notes, quote, the spread of COVID-19 has further highlighted how the failures to meet these standards of care are a matter of life and death. This comes as at least 160 Democratic members of Congress sent a letter to the inspector general demanding an investigation into the reports a doctor in Georgia was performing hysterectomies on immigrant women at Irwin without their consent. This is Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey speaking Monday about whistleblower Dawn Wooten's allegations.
My heart has been broken by some of the things that I've read over the last couple of weeks. I'm definitely very concerned about what we heard from the whistleblower Dawn Wooten about the barbaric treatment of detainees at Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. And if these allegations are true, this is really probably one of the most inhumane things I have heard coming out of an administration that I think has very little bottom to its low.
All of this comes as ICE has now temporarily halted the deportation of Pauline Bynum, a Cameroonian mother who says she was involuntarily sterilized while detained in Georgia. Bynum was already on the plane Wednesday when her deportation was stopped. She's lived in the United States since the age of two. For more, we're joined in Atlanta by Dawn Wooten, the licensed practical nurse who filed this widely discussed whistleblower complaint to the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General about abuses at the privately run Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. Also with us in Atlanta, Azadeh Shashahani, legal and advocacy director at Project South, which helped file the complaint. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dawn Wooten, let's begin with you on this issue of forced sterilization of hysterectomies that is included in this complaint. Can you explain what the women mean when they talk about a uterus collector?
I've had several women to come to me over the course of time. And in my last attendance there at Irwin County Detention Center, I had a couple of women to come to me and say, you know, every time we go out or every time we go to this place and talking with other detained women there, that they had this in common. They would talk about him being the uterus collector. And in hearing it, you know, you don't know what to say or how to respond. But that was the term that they had given at the time. Was that he's the uterus collector. Her actual question was, what does he do? What does he go around collecting everybody's uterus? You know, it's jaw-dropping. There's really not a response to give them for that terminology, but that's the terminology that was given to me.
And Dawn Wooten, how many of these women were you able to talk to directly, and or were some of them giving you the secondhand information that they had heard from other women in the center?
Yes, they become family whenever they cohabitate together. They build what they call families inside of the dormitories, and they share experiences and they share life story there, and they become really close. So in coming into, in hearing, you know, they had devised that term, the uterus collector.
And you've also raised in your complaint the situation in terms of the treatment of detainees in general about in reference to COVID. Could you talk about the direct experiences that you had with how the facility was dealing with COVID patients?
Yes, in March, whenever we first come across COVID-19, the first case that was there was not a case. You know, like it was invisible. It was a silence. You know, we were not to share it with other employees. We were not to share it with outside. We were not to share it amongst ourselves. There was a time to where I was told that you don't inform the officers that this person is COVID positive. You know, in the beginning, they didn't take wearing masks seriously. We didn't have proper PPE in the beginning. It was like a coverall. It never existed. And as time progressed inside of the facility and there were more cases that systemically appeared, we were still at a place there to where it was unbelievable. We didn't have it. Don't you talk about it. Don't you discuss it. That's not true. I am a mother with an underlying condition. I have kids that have underlying conditions. And once the terms came to, hey, there's COVID-19 inside of this facility, they were not reporting to the health department. They were not reporting to the CDC. So there were cases in the beginning that were not accounted for. They were not justified. And I became in fear, not just for myself, but for the lives of others that were around me, as well as my children. We had N95s. I received one in March. I asked for one again in May, and I was told that you're going to have to put this in a bag. You were given one in March. And until July the 2nd, last day at the facility, I still hadn't received a N95 that I knew was in the building. And I had it detaining to someone stopped me in the hall and said, can you check this man's temp? I went to check the detainee's temp. It was 101.8. I went and I concurred with my supervisor. And one nurse said that she checked it. It was 97.3. You know, going back to check it a second time, it's 101.8. He had a valid temp. I was told that they wrapped themselves in cover. It has to depend on what time of day. Hand him some ibuprofen. That's not professional nursing. That is not something that I can do. He was not tested. You have several detainees that will come up and they will be symptomatic. But I was told that everybody reads the news, everybody sees the news. They know how to present the symptoms coming across the news. It was inhumane and it was not justifiably correct. I live by you treat people how you want to be treated. You don't treat people as if they don't exist and they were ignored. The sanitation, we didn't have anything to sanitize with. There was no hand sanitizer. We were not wiping down 6 feet distance. There was not 6 feet distance. We're all a couple of nurses in a room. And not only were detainees positive, but there were also employees positive. It wasn't taken seriously. And I feared for my life and the lives of those that I'm around.
You yourself, Dawn Wooten, suffer from sickle cell. You voiced your complaints about the lack of protection for staff, like you, a nurse, as well as the prisoners. Can you talk about whether or not you think that was related to your demotion?
I do. I have sickle cell. I had to have a minute procedure. And when I took it to my supervisor, I was told, even though you're going to be COVID tested, you can still come to work, wear a mask. I was symptomatic. I went to the physician earlier on in this COVID case at Rowan County Detention Center. I was diagnosed with an upper respiratory infection. I had fluid on the lung. I was taking inhalation or breathing treatments. I was on antibiotics. I was running a temp. I had diarrhea. I had headaches. I had chest pain. I had a cough. Arrest because I was told I still could present to work because my test confirmed that I was negative, but I was symptomatic.
I wanted to bring Azadeh Shashahani into the conversation because we just reported that another person has died in an ICE prison, not at Irwin, where Nurse Wooten worked, but in a separate facility. And I was wondering if you can tell us the latest news on him.
Sure, Amy. Thank you very much for having me. First, I wanted to say that as Project South, we're part of a movement that believes that systematic state violence is not to be tolerated in any form. So whether it's ICE caging and harming immigrants or cops murdering Black people in the streets with impunity. And we are truly honored as Project South to be representing Ms. Wooten along with the Government Accountability Project. She's truly a hero. For telling us about these outrageous conduct on behalf of the facility. So, you know, we don't really know very much about the death of Cipriano Chavez Alvarez, a 61-year-old man. He was a Mexican national. As far as I know, ICE has not even issued a press statement at this point. But what we do know is that this marks the third death at the Stewart Detention Center, also a corporate run facility, during the pandemic. So three men have already died of COVID-19 or complications related to COVID-19. And two of them were elderly, including Mr. Cipriano Chavez Alvarez, and the other one, Santiago Button Oxlash, was a 34-year-old man who had diabetes. So the question is, why would ICE continue to hold people who are elderly or have pre-existing conditions in a facility that we already know is a deadly one? You know, seven people have died at the Stewart Detention Center just in the past 3 years, two of them by suicide after being placed in solitary for prolonged periods of time. So, you know, those of us on the ground who have called for this facility, Stewart, as well as Irving, to be shut down for a long time, the question that we have is, what else would it take for decision makers to finally move and do something about this before we see additional tragedies at these facilities?
Well, Azadeh, we played at the beginning of this segment a clip of some women at the facility talking about the conditions back in April. Could you talk about the context of that and what happened to those women after this video got out?
Sure. So instead of addressing their concerns and actually taking care of the people inside to make sure that this deadly disease does not spread, the facility run by a private corporation, LaSalle, proceeded to retaliate against all the women who were involved in the making of that video in any way. So they placed them in solitary confinement for a number of days, and that led to extreme emotional and mental health damage for all of them.
And one of the most egregious points raised in the complaint of Dawn Wooten is this whole issue of whether there had been sterilizations of women occurring at Irwin without their consent. Could you talk about what your organization knows about this and to how extensive it is?
Sure. So, you know, thanks to Ms. Dawn Wooten and her courage in coming out about all of this and, you know, the documentation and the complaint that we were able to release, that has really opened the door to a lot of lawyers coming forward, a lot of immigrants coming forward. We are in touch with lawyers, you know, trying to track down women all over the world who have been at this facility and have suffered some type of violation to their body. It is truly egregious that immigrant women at a truly vulnerable situation at this facility, at the mercy of ICE and the LaSalle Corporation, were treated in this fashion. And so, what we do know is that there were hysterectomies, there were other procedures that were done on women without their consent. And I would like to address ICE's response in terms of, the number of hysterectomies. First of all, what they said is that they know of only two people being referred for hysterectomies. Part of what we're saying is that, based on what we know about what was happening and what this doctor was doing, people may have been referred for something else, you know, a minor issue like what happened with Pauline Binham. You know, she went in for a minor issue, and then the next thing she knew, her fallopian tube was taken out. That led to a sterilization. So, you know, the question is, what happened at the doctor's office in terms of the procedures? And secondly, you know, those of us who have been doing immigrants' rights work for a long time know that ICE has no moral credibility whatsoever. And anything that they say should be taken with a grain of salt. And also, there are assertions about shredding of medical information at this facility. And so that also shines, a doubt on what ICE is asserting here. And lastly, they are themselves saying that they haven't been able to determine the true number of gynecological procedures that were done on women. So, you know, that is why we issued the complaint. There is absolutely a need for an independent and thorough investigation by the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General and by Congress, and we need to shut this place down.
So we reported earlier Tina Vasquez at PRISM and other outlets, including The New York Times, say that the doctor is an obstetrics and gynecology specialist named Mahendra Mean, who has an office in the city of Douglas near the ICE jail. It's been reported that he and other doctors previously paid $500,000 in a settlement of a civil federal Medicare fraud allegation years ago. What do you know about him? You have ICE, Dr. Ada Rivera, the medical director of ICE Health Services Corporation, saying the reports would be investigated, but that the agency, quote, vehemently disputes the implication that detainees are used for experimental medical procedures. What do you know about Dr. Mahendra Amin in particular? And overall, are more doctors involved, Azadeh?
So what the media has reported about Dr. Amin, and I should clarify that Project South, the Government Accountability Project, and our client, Ms. Wooten, are not able to confirm the identity of the doctor. But what the media has reported about Dr. Amin is that this person was not even board certified, which, raises the question about, the level of care that ICE has for the people in its custody, that they would send people over a number of years to a physician who was not even board certified. And what the media has reported is that, in addition to the settlement that you mentioned with the Department of Justice, Dr. Amin was also involved in a series of lawsuits. So that all, remains to be investigated. We do not know for sure at this point whether there were other physicians involved, in terms of what was happening at the facility, in terms of referring people to him. That all needs to be investigated. And again, that is why we filed the report.
Is he still operating at the jail?
From what we know, they have stopped referring people to Dr. Amin, but that happened very, very late in the game.
Dawn Wooten, I know you have to leave, and we so appreciate you taking this time. Do you fear for your own safety as you speak out? And what happens to those inside the prison, the immigrant women who speak out?
Safety is an issue. Haven't gotten any, wild threats or anybody saying, that, hey, we're going to come after you. But at the same time, it's the issue, because anytime that you hold morally and ethically and you do what's right and correct, you have to realize that now I've become a target. The voice and the ladies that are there at the facility. Yes, I empathize with those ladies that are speaking out at the facility, because we live in the real world and we process things, in the real world differently. So there is, as women, we're supposed to remain silent according to the world, and we're not supposed to have a voice. So in speaking out, I am concerned for them and for how they're going to be treated and isolated.
Yeah, I'd also like to ask Azadeh Shashashani, a lot of people don't realize still, unfortunately, that the people held in detention, in ICE detention, that this is are largely there on civil issues and are awaiting hearings in their cases. They are not criminals, yet they are treated in large part by the government's detention centers as criminals.
Well, I mean, I should say that obviously, regardless of what offense a person may have been accused of or not, in this really corrupt criminal legal process, obviously everybody is entitled to human rights, fundamental human rights, and we should be fighting for everybody's human dignity the same. It is true that these facilities are civil detention centers, and the people held in these facilities, many of them are awaiting deportation proceedings, or they may be asylum seekers. They may be afraid of torture in their home countries, and that is why they fled to the U.S. to try to find refuge in this country. And instead, You know, the U.S. government places them in these horrid places where, you know, they are denied basic human rights in terms of medical care, clean water, you know, good food, edible food. And when they complain, the U.S. government and the private prison corporations retaliate against them by, you know, using tear gas in some cases, placing them in solitary confinement and trying to basically, you know, shut down their voices.
And the significance of now the House calling for an investigation into all of this. I mean, you had Houston Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee. You have Pramila Jayapal, before she was a congressmember, major immigrant rights activist in Seattle, leading this charge and getting 160 congressmembers to sign on, which led to Pauline Bynum being taken off the plane as it was about to take off in Chicago. What do you want to see come out of this investigation?
Yeah, that is huge, you know, especially, again, those of us on the ground have been calling for a number of years on Congress to act, and they did not, even after people started dying at Stewart. They didn't do anything significant. And then, you know, as a result of the national outrage last week, we are glad that finally Congress is paying attention. We have been contacted by multiple congressional staffers about the complaint. And so, you know, we do hope that there is continued pressure on the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General to ensure that they conduct a thorough and independent investigation into violations at the facility. And, you know, there's been a lot of attention on, you know, the evils that the doctor did. But you know, the problem goes beyond this one doctor. These were people in the custody of the U.S. government. You know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with ICE and with the U.S. government. And so they need to be held accountable as well as the private prison corporation. And what we are demanding is that the facility be shut down.
Azadeh Shashahani, I want to thank you so much for being with us, legal and advocacy director at Project South. And Dawn Wooten, thanks so much for joining us, licensed practical nurse who filed a whistleblower complaint about the abuses at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. We will continue to cover this issue. When we come back, we'll look at Belly of the Beast, a new documentary on California's dark history of forced sterilizations inside women's prisons. Stay with us.
If not now, then when? If not today, then why make your promises? A love declared for days to come is as good as none. The morning comes, you can wait for the new day. You can wait and lose this heart. You can wait and soon be sorry. 'Cause if not now.
If not now, by Tracy Chapman. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The horrific exposure of forced hysterectomies at an ICE jail in Georgia has forced a reckoning with the U.S.'s long history of sterilizations, particularly of black, brown, poor, and disabled people, and the way this procedure is continued in jails and prisons to the present day. We'll go now to California, where a new documentary is bringing one of these disturbing stories to light. In 2001, Kelly Dillon was sterilized at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. The mother of two in her early 20s was told she was going into surgery for ovarian cysts. She later learned she'd been given a hysterectomy. Dillon was not alone. According to a report from Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting, between 2006 and 10, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation sterilized nearly 150 women without required state approval. Prison staff reportedly targeted and coerced women who they thought were likely to return to prison. Up to 100 more may have undergone the same treatment as far back as 1997. The revelations were a chilling reminder of the 20th century eugenics program in which 32 states, including California, forcibly sterilized people, many poor, disabled, and people of color for decades. In 2006, Kelly Dillon became the first survivor of sterilization abuse to sue the California Department of Corrections for damages. Belly of the Beast tells her story and chronicles her fight to hold the state of California accountable. This is the film's trailer.
There is a culture of secrecy in California.
I have some fear. What kind of repercussions will I get for coming on and talking about this?
I've always been a fighter, but it wasn't truly birthed until I was in prison.
He did a pelvic exam.
He said I had a fibroid.
I was told that I had cancer cells.
When I came out, I felt like something was wrong.
We were getting hundreds of letters about medical abuses every month.
When was the first time a doctor told you that you may be missing your ovaries?
No one ever told me that. I have been intentionally sterilized, and I have been lied to.
Law prohibits sterilizing people in prison for the purpose of birth control, but they were doing it anyway.
One of the challenges with this story is you ultimately have to get to intent. And then that's when the doctor said, well, that's cheaper than welfare.
I was looking at these documents that was confirming as a black woman, my life wasn't. I was very much intimidated by whom I was going up against.
The state has admitted that they have done these illegal surgeries, but we don't actually know who they did them on.
Humans become numbers. You don't get names. And that's what makes it easy to abuse them.
Women in California being coercively sterilized is absolutely revolting.
After all this pain, I'll never be the same.
We have yet to get an apology. We have yet to be acknowledged. The state has to be made accountable.
'Cause some wounds never healed. Do you see what you done?
That's the trailer for Belly of the Beast. We're joined now by Kelly Dillon herself, whose fight against the California Department of Corrections is the subject of Belly of the Beast. Also the founder of community empowerment organization Back to Basics in Los Angeles and in Salt Lake City, Utah. We're joined by the film's director, Erica Cohn. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Well, Kelly, let's begin with you. Go back to 2006. Again, you became the first survivor of sterilization abuse to sue the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation for damages. In 2014, California banned coerced sterilizations. Many people say it's largely because of what you started in 2006. Take us back to when you were imprisoned and what happened to you.
As I'm sitting here listening to the stories that Don Wooten is expressing about some of the detainees in the ICE facility, those stories ring so parallel to my story of what was happening. I was 19 years old when I was first sent to prison. And at the age of 23, I had some regular, I will say female issues that I was seeking out, the doctor for. And then I was told that I had an abnormal pap smear and that I would need a cone biopsy to check that out. And so I agreed to it. And then we discussed cancer, me and the doctor, we discussed that if they found cancer, would I want a hysterectomy? I was young at the time, very much uneducated, didn't really know the procedures or any other medical options. And I was scared of cancer like most of us are. And I said, okay, yes, if you find cancer, then you could perform the hysterectomy. But when he went in to do the cone biopsy and to also remove what they say possibly was some cysts, he intentionally cut off the blood supply to my ovaries and then began to perform what was a sterilization on me.
And Kelly, when, how soon afterwards did you realize that something was wrong with what they had done to you? And could you tell us about what it was like to trace back the sequence of events of what they had done to you?
Yes. So, you know, I tell people that, you know, spiritually, we, you know, of course we feel connected to certain things. And immediately coming out of the surgery, I just felt like, okay, number one, I was scared if I had cancer, but then I just felt different. Just in the days of recovery, it just felt like something wasn't right. But I didn't pay it any attention. I just thought maybe it was just my nerves. And when the doctor came in and told me that he didn't find any cancer, didn't tell me anything else, you know, I was relieved. But then several months after that, I began to experience menopausal symptoms at the age of 24. I had hot flashes, heart palpitations, and just different things that was happening to me. And I said, no, something has to be going on. And when I began to question or write the staff and the prison to see, well, what happened to me, to get some answers as to what happened in surgery, they began to start giving me the runaround. So actually, it took, with the help of an agency called Justice Now and a social activist attorney by the name of Cynthia Chandler, who's also in the film, it took us about a year or so for us to get my medical records, to actually fight, to write, to almost sue them just for the medical records. And when I finally got them, she was the one who told me, as she read through the medical records, that I had been intentionally sterilized. And that's something that I, you know, that people need to know, is that we don't have access to those, that medical information. And it's withheld, even though to everyone else, it just may seem like a privilege to ask for a copy of a procedure that happened to you. But for us, we are withheld that information. And if we begin to press, as you guys discussed in the ICE Detention Center, we are reprimanded and also sometimes put in lockdown or you know, different situations. We're punished to go after those medical records.
Yeah, and in terms of the why did you finally decide to come forward and talk about your experience?
Yes, it took a lot of nerve for me to even first sue them for what had happened while still incarcerated. I had received a lot of different threats from the medical staff, the chief medical officer, as well as some of the correctional officers that was in there, about the repercussions that I would face if I continue on in my lawsuit. But the question is, like, what would you do if you found out that something like this would happen to you? And I just felt like I could not allow CDC to continue on. But the real press of me wanting to seek justice had a lot to do with the fact that I had begun to see other women that was around my age, around childbearing age, between any of, like, maybe 24 to 35 years of age, coming back with all of these hysterectomies. And even though we didn't say that they were the uterus collector, like they're that, like that doctor is coined in Georgia, but I begin to see that, well, what is happening, that mostly African-American women or women of color are needed, come in very healthy, strong, childbearing women, and then all of a sudden we need all of these hysterectomies. And so for that, the fight wasn't just for me. The fight was also for my sisters that I had saw that had been wronged as well. It's just that I had the privilege of having a actual legal team to assist me in the journey.
I want to go to another clip from the new documentary, Belly of the Beast.
You gave me a hysterectomy for severe cramps.
We did a pelvic exam.
He gave me some kind of test and said I had some fibroid.
I was told that I had cancer cells.
They told me that I had to have my ovaries removed. I had no choice.
We actually used to call them the surgeries of the month because they were happening so frequently. So many people were getting hysterectomies. That was a cure-all. That's what it was.
So So that's a clip from Belly of the Beast, and we want to bring in the film's director, Erica Cohn. Erica, through your research, you determined that between 1997 and 2013, over 1,400 sterilizations were performed. Can you talk about this shocking figure and the work you did, the years you've spent on this documentary?
Thank you so much for having me. We calculated that between California state audit and prison records that nearly, as you mentioned, 1,400 sterilization procedures occurred between 1997 and 2013. And since 2014, since a bill was passed in California rendering sterilization for the purpose of birth control illegal, which I think it's important to note, it was already illegal according to state, federal, and international law. California is required to report the number of sterilization procedures performed each year and prove medical necessity around each procedure. And, you know, one of the ways that California was able to find a loophole around these procedures previously was because they were able to classify them as medically necessary, when we know in many instances these procedures actually were not medically necessary. And so I believe that accountability, holding our institutions accountable, is the only way that we can prevent future abuses like these from happening.
And Erica Cohn, of course, these situations happening in the last 20 years, there's actually a much longer history of this. For instance, it's been well documented that in Puerto Rico in the late 1940s and 1950s, there was a systemic sterilization of women of childbearing age. Estimates about one third of all women of childbearing age in Puerto Rico were sterilized during that period, again, as a family planning or birth control a system without any kind of explanation to the women of what was actually happening. Informed consent didn't come until the 1970s or 80s as a requirement. So there's been a long history in this country of this type of oppression of women, hasn't there?
Absolutely. Yes. Forced sterilization is genocide. And the legacy of forced sterilization in the United States is deeply rooted in white supremacy. And my actual connection to the story comes from that eugenics history. You know, I was first introduced to Cynthia Chandler in 2010, the attorney who's featured in the film, through a mutual friend. And I was really inspired by her work at Justice Now. Specifically, the Let Our Families Have a Future campaign, which really exposed the multiple ways that prisons destroy the basic human right to family. One of the most heinous being the illegal sterilizations primarily targeting women of color. And as a Jewish woman who grew up in Salt Lake City 25 years ago, the phrase never again was always profoundly in the back of my mind. And when I learned there was a different kind of genocide happening through imprisonment, through forced sterilization behind bars, I knew that I wanted to get involved. And initially, it was by becoming a volunteer with Justice Now and later becoming a volunteer legal advocate working with over 150 people who were incarcerated in California's women's prisons. And as you see in the film, and as you're talking about, that history of eugenics in the United States is not something that we talk about a lot. When we hear the word eugenics, we think of Nazi Germany, we think of the Holocaust. But actually, what we don't talk about is the founding of the eugenics movement in the United States, and actually how Nazi Germany came to California to learn from our eugenics leaders to take our policies and practices back.
We're going to leave it there, but do part two and have a continued conversation with you. I do want to give Kelly the last word. You have 10 seconds. What would justice look like for you?
So right now we have a petition that's on www.bellyofthebeastfilm.org. .com, and what we're trying to do is seek compensation in order to all the survivors to not only be identified, but to be notified, because there's a lot of hidden victims. And so we're looking for compensation for not only the survivors, but for the ones that are unknown as well.
Kelly Dillon, thanks so much for being with us as well. Thank you to Erica Cohn, director of Belly of the Beast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much.